Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Consortium, Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Angie Coro, host of the nationally syndicated radio program In Deep and program curator for the new Roku channel Mix TV. It is my pleasure to introduce our special guest, acclaimed political satirist Will Durst.
Acclaimed.
Now, we here in the Bay Area might like to think of Will as our very own, and he is, of course, based locally, but we're more of a touchdown point with his lifestyle. We're kind of a rest stop between tours and travel that take him around the country more than any of us would probably want to consider. He does comedy tours. He MCs corporate events. He does voiceover work. He's been a radio host, a TV commentator. In fact, his PBS series, Livelihood, was nominated for an Emmy. All these various roles feed off one thing, his unique perspective on the politics and the people in America. He is sardonic, but he's rarely mean, occasionally, but rarely mean. He has definite opinions, but he's very hard to pigeonhole. And of course, he's very funny. In fact, he's been nominated 7 consecutive times for the American Comedy Awards Stand-Up Comedian of the Year.
Never won.
Ladies and gentlemen, Will Durst.
I lost. Thank you. I lost to Carrot Top one year. I know. And Bill Hicks was nominated that same year, and he lost to Carrot Top. So you can imagine we're not happy.
Who's the woman who was always getting nominated for the same soap opera again and again?
Susan Lucci.
You are the Susan Lucci of the stand-up comedy world.
No, I never won an Emmy. I never won a stand-up. I haven't won a toaster. Not even at a bank.
Well, the election is over.
Oh, God.
Does that mean you rest up now?
No, yes, but I have to recalibrate my entire act. What a lovely 18 months that was. With all the characters, you know, I mean, and everybody led the polls. They just didn't like Mitt Romney. They didn't like him. I mean, this is part of my act, but everybody had a shot. You know, it was Palin led the polls, Trump, Bachman, Perry, Christie, Kane, Gingrich, Santorum. They all led the polls at one time. Oh, all right, Mitt. You know, and, so now those names, I mean, it's archaic. It's like talking about Hammurabi or something. So I have to recalibrate and shrink all that and come up with some generic stuff and the fiscal cliff, and nobody really cares because they know it's not a cliff. It's more like a slope.
Do they know that?
They should.
Yeah, I guess it's out there.
And even if, you know, we don't have a problem and it goes to January 2nd, they'll make it retroactive. We've done this before. We've done this so many times. I don't know why people are so upset about it, but they are.
But, you know, that brings up one of the questions, which is if you're talking to a Will Durst audience is going to be an informed audience, but the level of information is going to vary from person to person. So how do you tweak your commentary so you access the people who know everything about the fiscal cliff, including that it's not, and people who just know the phrase, fiscal cliff?
Yeah. I try to do that, and I try to have a joke in there.
That would be good.
Yeah. Hence the job title, comedian. What I try to do is make sure that every punchline is a setup for the next joke so that they get all their information, because the audience has the attention span of high-speed Lent. So, and the worst part is, you know, when I'm doing a comedy club, and it's hard to do comedy clubs because the kids don't care about politics. You don't care about politics until you have kids or mortgage or something like that. My generation was different because, you know, we were going to stop a war, man. You know, so it was all different back then. But the kids, I do politics at a comedy club, and they stare at me like, why is this bitter old man lecturing me? So I just got to keep coming up with jokes. I mean, that's just my. I don't have to, but that's my rhythm.
Well, what would you do otherwise?
Well, I mean, everybody has different rhythms. You know, I mean, you look at Louis Black, and he's sputtering, and he can't you know, he can't verbalize, you know, because he's so emotional about it, and it's a great way, you know, but it's just, and mine is kind of, because I was forged in the Central Valley, one-nighters in Stockton, and if you weren't, if they weren't laughing, they were throwing stuff, so so I tried to keep them.
Well, since you anticipated my This Is Your Life, Will Durston, let's take you all the way back to Milwaukee, where you were born as a small boy. And
there's questions about that. Yeah.
Is there a Midwestern sensibility? Did that have anything to do with shaping you, if it does exist?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe the work ethic, maybe the blue collar. My dad was a union guy. I always kind of related to the underdog, and Milwaukee was kind of written off as, you know, a backwater town, and Bushville. I mean, that's what there's an actual, in 1957 when the Milwaukee Braves beat the New York Yankees, and the New York Press called Milwaukee Bushville. You know, it was, so I always took that to heart, and I still have a soft spot in my heart and my head for Milwaukee. You know, I just I think it's a great town, and undiscovered little jewel. Except I go back there, you know, like two or three times a year, and say hello to my friends, and we go to a bar, and I think, oh, this is so idyllic, and you know, and rustic, and bucolic. It's very icky, you know, all the icks. And I could live here, like, and then I realized, no, I would die in a bar fight in about a week. Because guys are yelling at the TV for exactly 180 degrees about why I would be yelling at the TV.
What about your West Coast sensibilities that you've developed now? I mean, would that doom you there?
Well, I think that's one of the things that attracted me to the Bay Area was, you know, ostensibly growing up on the fringes, you know, the tangents of show business, because in Milwaukee, you know, there was no real show business, you know, there were like flats and costumes and lights, and that was about it. And so I, coming out to the Bay Area, you know, the whole live and let live thing about the Bay Area was something that struck me deeply. You know, gay, who cares? Who gives a rat's ass, you know, about your sexual, so I, you know, black and white and gay and straight, you know, it didn't really, and that's what I loved about the Bay Area, because it's the petri dish of social change. It is. I mean, everything starts here. You know, cigarettes, bags in grocery stores. You know, we're cultural. You know, living, you know, ramps, handicap. I mean, we're the forward thing. And you think about it. Everybody on the planet wants to live in America. Everybody in America wants to live in California. Everybody in California with an IQ of triple digits wants to live in the Bay Area. I mean, we are the chosen people, so with great power comes great responsibility.
You were a politician who decided to get your message out, or a politically aware person who decided to get your message out via comedy, or you were a comedian who eventually decided that politics was your shtick?
Yes.
That last part?
No, both.
Both?
Both. My dad read three newspapers a day, and he was a machinist, you know. Kearney and Tracker, but he read three newspapers a day. So, and my stepfather, who was a civil engineer, he read three newspapers a day. So you can imagine, you know, shuttling between these two households, and I did shuttle. You take them. The newspaper was a constant, and I just started reading, and I went to journalism school, you know. Dabbled in journalism and theater and film, and you know, in high school I was writing, and everything was political back then. In 1970, when I graduated from high school, it was right in the middle of Vietnam, and some of you older folks out there, you know, you remember those days. Everything was, your blue jeans were political, whether they were creased or faded properly. Your haircut was definitely political, so everything was political. And I just started, I wanted to reflect, and I didn't date, so I didn't have a lot of relationship humor.
You didn't date because why?
I don't know, I was a geek, long hair, glasses, sits.
Were you shy?
Oh yeah, still that. No, I know. It's the comedy thing. It's I can do it when I'm on stage. You know, I mean when everybody. This is still creepy because I don't have the jokes to fall back on.
So when did stand-up come in? When did you start doing that? Tell us about your earliest stand-up.
Oh, I wanted to do stand-up a bunch of times. I wanted to do it. I tried a couple of times. I moved out to California 3 or 4 times. Kept trying to do stuff. And a couple of times, I moved out there and I run back to California. This is what I would do. I did stand-up comedy in high school once in one of those assemblies, you know, talent things, and me and a buddy did and I remember we sang a song, an old British song called, that Led Zeppelin had covered on one of their albums, and it's this old, it was, the baby got thrown out with the bathwater, right, and so we sang that song, and I remember the power of just, because I had been in plays and comedies, and I knew about getting a laugh, but the power of just the two of us, you know, and the audience laugh, so that was high school, and I always kind of dug the comics on the Carson show, because I would babysit for my brother and sister a lot, and be able to stay up and watch Carson, and I dug the and I didn't care who they were, you know, Jan Murray, or Jackie Vernon, or, you know, I mean, they weren't hip guys, you know, they were doing like a lot of mother-in-law jokes, but I just thought it was cool, you know, a man and a microphone, the final frontier. You know, just doing it on your own.
Well, when you talk about the comedians that you admired as you grew up, the Examiner eventually ended up calling you a combination of Mort Saul and Will Rogers. And you have that quote on your website too, willdurst.com.
Yeah.
If you look at those two people, I mean, here you have Will Rogers, who, I mean, he played the vaudeville circuit. He played New York. He was successful in radio, you know, eventually, you know, in movies to some extent. And then you have Mort Saul, who became so political that he bottomed out, that he was essentially blacklisted. And I wonder how you look at that as how far you can go with your politics, your opinions, and still be more Will Rogers successful than Mort Saul out of the question anymore.
Well, I don't think it's my job to proselytize one side or the other. If I'm going to be an advocate for something, it's going to be for, you know, something of a humanistic spirit. And, you know, can't we all get along, you know, the Rodney King thing. But my job is to make fun of these guys. Because with laughter, sometimes hope can follow through, you know, on the inhale. And so if you can laugh at it, you diminish it, and you don't make it so like what Mel Brooks did with Nazis, for Christ's sake. I mean, Nazis, and he made fun of Hitler, which is so cool, you know, and must be so liberating, and just to bring it down from this, you know, mythic. Nah, he's just a dick. And then you slap.
You have a book called Bipartisan Bashing.
The All-American Sport of Bipartisan Bashing, yeah.
But bipartisan, as we're starting to see people catch on to, there have been a number of editorials that there's not an equality between the sides. And a lot of journalism is catching up, saying that we can't equivalate and say one side, the other side. We have to start calling some truth about whether one side is, you know, inherently less honest, whether the other one is orchestrating more. Talk to me about how you feel about the duality of American politics right now.
Well, I call myself a bipartisan smartass, and I take out the Republicans, because Republicans see everything in terms of black and white. You know, Democrats, conservatives, it's all us versus them. It's, you know, Bush, and it's black versus white, and everything. I mean, you know, it's religion. It's all God. God is good, and everything else is bad, and our God is good. And so it's much more, it's easier to make fun of those kind of views, because they don't allow for any gray area. Whereas, you know, the liberals, the Democrats, you know, they're all about gray area, and maybe sometimes too much about gray area. You know, it's like, well, you can't call them handicapped anymore. You have to call them, well, okay, we'll call them physically challenged. No, they're not physically challenged. Well, what do you want to call them? I mean, it doesn't matter what you call them. Just build them a frickin' ramp. You know, I mean, they don't care. So that's one of the problems that I have with the liberals, you know. And the fact that, and I like this part about being liberal, that accept the very definition of the term means accepting of many viewpoints, you know, and which is why when you have the Occupy movement, and the Occupy movement was, it was pivotal, I think, in the last election in raising the income inequality and the greed, the corporate greed. But the problem is, you know, you got to let everybody in. You know, we're Occupy Wall Street. We're talking about greed. And then the global warming people show up. Oh, all right, here you go. You know. And then the dolphin-free tuna people want to, oh, okay. And then once you let them in, you got to let the tuna-free dolphin people in, you know, no judgment. And then the reggae club needs a place to practice, and then the homeless wander by because the reggae club is handing out brownies, and you know, pretty soon you got no focus.
That is the best synopsis of some of the Occupy problems I've ever heard. But there are problems with the Democrats as well. I mean, for example, you know what happened in Michigan, although they got the same notice from the election everybody else got, it was a fairly decisive election. A decision that what Mitt Romney was talking about was not acceptable to the majority of Americans. However, they've gone ahead to move against unions. And over here in California, where the equally decisive message was heard, even though Michigan is moving forward with its agenda, despite the election, the Democrats here are saying, you know, we don't want to overstep. We don't want to take too much advantage of the fact that we have a majority and most power. There's something in there about that nature of the Democrat, the timidity.
Yeah, that's true, but it's also an opening stance. I mean,
yes.
You know that. They're not going to say, we're going to change everything, and it'll be good, you watch, you know, because it won't be, and then they're stuck with their promises. So they're going to take, it makes sense to do incremental. It's like the fiscal cliff, you know, Boner or Boehner, whatever his name is. The family is named Boner. He's got 11 brothers and sisters. They're all Boners. This is true. He's the only Boehner in the family. I'm not kidding. His mother's a Boner. His father, well, 12 kids. You do the math. All right. So when Boehner says, have to have a couple of jokes. When Boehner says, well, the president's not giving us anything. Well, you know, that's his opening stance, and it makes sense. And he's got his people who are looking at that, and they need to see that he's, you know, standing up for them. He's going to make a deal, probably. And the same thing with Obama. You know, no, we're not. And then, because that's the opening stance, because it's a negotiation. And you don't have to worry about it until December 31st. And then they get a little closer, and then they get a little, you know, and they might not even get together, but a deal will happen.
But if you have this, but if you
remember TARP, they wouldn't vote for TARP. Remember, the Republicans wouldn't vote for TARP, and then the stock market shot down 600 points, and then suddenly 2 days later, oh yeah, well, yeah, all right. So, and it might take the stock market to shoot down 600 points.
But if you had those two stances written down, and you didn't associate either one with the party, let's just say Party A says we're not budging. Party B says, oh, we don't want to be rude. You know which party was which.
We don't want to be rude. Yeah. Like that, yeah. Well, that's one of my jokes, that the Democrats, the reason they were so intent to passing the stem cell bill is they're depending on that research to generate a spine.
Did you expect Mitt Romney to disappear so sinking without a bubble, disappeared the next day? Did you expect that?
I did not. You know, after that first debate, I, like every other liberal in America, was and checking 538.com because Nate Silver was the only redeeming that nervous, and then oh no, 71%. Okay, he thinks so. He was right last time, and so every liberal I know went to 538.com just to be able to breathe. And Romney was such a bad candidate at every turn. He lost to a black guy during a lousy economy. Hello? They didn't have any good candidates. They just, I mean, you think about it, they had good people. There's still people on the bench. And Christie didn't run. And say what you will about Christie, he's popular. And he's not a populist, but he's popular. And Mitch Daniels, I'm not a big fan of his policies. I know people in Indiana who are just like me. Pawlenty, I mean, they had Huckabee. Could have been, and none of these guys ran. You had Rick Perry, Rick Perry, who's making plans to run again in 2016. Yes. Let the guy be inaugurated, for Christ's sake. and Romney was the guy. And he wouldn't reveal his tax records, and you can't tell me that there's not anything there that would have been embarrassing. And I think a lot of people felt that way. And he went to Great Britain and pissed off the entire country. Great Britain, that's not one of the tough ones. The 47% comment. He went to a rally. A rally, one of his own rallies. And he made fun of his supporters' cookies because they were store-bought. Apparently the pastry chef wasn't on duty that way. He was just a bad candidate.
You can see that, I don't know whether it was generational or worldview, but there was a real divide there between the use of social media, how cleverly Obama was able to reach out to different people through his website, through Twitter, going online to Reddit and having a conference there. And then you had Mitt Romney, who spelled America wrong on his website and had to take it back down.
Spell it with a K?
No, it was Immersia, which became a hashtag.
Immersia,
yeah. They fixed it, but not before he was thoroughly embarrassed. It just seemed odd with so much money and so many minds, that they have access to, that they just couldn't get that social media thing down.
And also, when Obama used social media in 2008 in its nascent form, what he did with the interweb, and it should have been studied and, copied. And I'm sure it will be next time. But maybe Hillary would be, leaped out in front. You don't think? You don't think?
Well, let the guy get inaugurated.
I agree. Clinton Bush, it's 1992 all over again.
So there is this lame duck period between the election and your big annual thing, which is your New Year's bash, and you run around the Bay Area doing a week of New Year's shows.
Yes.
And what's fair game right now? What's happening that you can feast on?
We do this thing at the end of the year. It's called the Big Fat Year-End Kiss-Off Comedy Show. And this is our 20th. And we're going to be in Walnut Creek at the Lesher. We'll be there, I think, the 28th. Lesher, yes, Saturday the 29th. The Lesher Center for the Arts, and these cards are out front. We had seven cities. We start in Berkeley on the day after Christmas. We end in Mill Valley on January 1st. And we've done it for 20 years. And it's me and Johnny Steele and Devin Mike and Mari Magaloni and Arthur Gauss. And we get together, and everybody does their own stand-up, but we also do skits and voiceovers. And one of the skits this year is it's a guy who goes and tries to get his health care, right? And he says, there's something wrong. I get a bad tooth. And, well, I'm sorry. It's not covered under health care. And, well, what about my eyes? No, that's not covered under health care. Well, what do you cover? Well, we cover your uterus. Well, I don't have a uterus. Well, that's too bad. And then he leaves, and another person comes, a guy comes in and says, "Hey, yeah, there's my uterus is killing me." Right? And the woman says, "Well, where does it hurt?" He says, "Ah, ah, ah." So we do skits and sketches, and one is about pizza, trying to order a pizza. Well, it's got Papa John's, right, it's right-wing pizza. So, and we're doing a voiceover about, remember Karl Rove on election night?
Yes.
Yeah, Karl Rove going, and now Karl Rove through the ages, Karl Rove at the Alamo, you know, Karl Rove at Little Big Horn, and finally Karl Rove, a six volume set of Karl Rove in Vietnam. They're tiny. They're wearing pajamas. We got this. You know. So that's what we do. And we try to look back over the year. And, you know, and this year, you know, everybody, because I call myself bipartisan, and my career has a definite kind of sine. No, it's a sine wave. And this, it's at the top during a presidential election, and then the year after presidential election, next year's going to suck. For me. And then 2014, it will be the midterms. And then 2015, they're already running for 2016 and again. So that's my, the sine wave of my career. So this year it was so Donald Trump pretending he was running for president. Oh my God. It was, yeah. And I know it's all Republican bashing, but in 4 years, you know, they'll have two primaries. But this year it was just one. Nobody challenged Obama. And, you know, remember Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter, which might have been why, in 1980. And, you know, so and I don't think Clinton was challenged in 96. I don't think, unless it was Jerry Brown. Remember Jerry Brown was running his 800 number? So, yeah, but... So this year has been pretty heavy on Republicans, and I apologize, but you wait. Next year, Democrats are back on target.
You mentioned your wife, Deb.
Funnier than I am, which pisses me off.
Well, talk about her voice in comedy. As a, you know, you're the, as you said, the grumpy old man, the lecturing guy, the politics. What does she do?
Debbie's an improviser. Debbie's been on that show, Whose Line Is It Anyway? The British version. And she was actually going to be one of the original cast members, but they already had a woman in Britain. And so when they came to San Francisco for auditions, they took Greg Proops and Michael McShane, and they were going to take a third person, but someone called from London and said, we got a woman. So Debbie was left off the initial... but she's been in movies. She's done a couple movies for Henry Selick, the guy who directed Nightmare Before Christmas. She was in that. And she's a comedy floozy is what she is. She works with everybody. She's been with every group, past committee. She wasn't with the committee. I think she guested when she was in high school with them for a couple of years. But ever since then, The Wing, Femprov, Comedy Underground, National Theater of the Deranged, Dinosaurs of Improv, The Riffingtons. She's just, and now she's doing community theater. So she's doing something downtown this week, Three Girls Squared. And it was just written up in the New York Times and the Sunday Pink section. So that's what she's doing. And she might be directing next year. But yeah, she's funny.
I thought of you guys because you and I have talked before about, you know, you don't have kids. You know, you're both in and out running crazy
like
careers.
No, like you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mine are furry. I don't have children either. But I thought of you when Ross Douthat came out last week and said, you know, talked about the decadence of the childless. And I just wondered if you'd had any reaction to his saying that. Did you catch that?
That was, I haven't read that. I heard about it. Someone, I didn't read it. I was out of town and I didn't want to, I was getting the New York Times delivered and I didn't want to buy one. Because, you know, you don't want to buy two New York Times in one day. Although I've done it before. I paid for two or three Chronicles in one day. But we are decadent. There is a reason. I mean, also the lifestyle. I was on the road. She was on the road. There was no way we could have kids. And also, thirdly, is we are kids. You can't have kids, have kids. It's not fair, and we don't share our toys well.
I'm going to ask you some of the questions that the audience has come out with. What do you think of Grover Norquist? That's wide open.
You know, I actually met him a couple of times. He always does this thing in D.C. called the funniest celebrity in D.C., and he always tries to tell jokes. And I emceed it a couple of times. One time I emceed it, one time I was the guest when they were counting up, and I shake his hand, and I actually called him Satan to his face. I said, "Satan, great to meet you." He thinks I'm funny, so I think he should have a stake through the heart. I really do.
You left that off when you met him.
No, I told him. I told him. Yeah, I told him evil. I actually went on stage, evil incarnate.
This is an interesting way of phrasing this. What's the funniest thing happening in the Middle East these days?
I don't know. Maybe Sacha Baron Cohen is filming another movie. That's about the only thing I could think of. It's dangerous over there, and the Taliban and Malala, and you just read about these horrible stories. And yeah, that's why I try to concentrate on national politics, because the humor is inherent. Now, my problem is I can't work internationally. I used to work internationally. I used to do Britain and Scotland, and actually performed in Paris. And, oh, my God, the crowd in Paris, you know, it was expats who were so hungry for English-speaking entertainment, and they would laugh at every syllable. Oh, my God, you think you're Charlie Chaplin, you go over there. You know? But I'm going to go over to Germany. I have a friend who is in Germany, and he's created a little English-speaking comedy circuit. And I'm going through my act trying to think of what's going to translate. And I think I've settled on being a baby boomer, because everybody can relate to that, and also global warming, and everybody can relate to that. Rather, because I go over there and I talk about Rick Perry, and they, you know, it's like I'm trying to teach a dog chess or something.
Who are the funniest presidents?
I think Clinton actually gave the best speeches, because he was the first guy to take them serious. You know, when they do the correspondence dinner and he was the first guy to take them seriously, and he would rehearse his material and practice. And I think he was, in terms of, you know, performance. Bush was funny inadvertently. But he also had a sense of humor about himself, you know, which kind of made it hard to hate him. I mean, you could dislike him and really abhor his policies, but he seemed like an affable guy, maybe too affable, maybe like sponge-worthy, you know.
Sponge-worthy?
Yeah, that you can mold.
Oh.
You know? Like the time where he actually said, "Well, I wasn't sure we should go to war, but they convinced me of it." You know? I'm not sure that's a good thing. But I always have these little cards, these 3x5 cards that I carry around, and taking notes. And at the end of the second Bush administration, the 8 years, which I call the Full Employment Act for political comedy, I had both sides chock full. I mean, just, you know, in double space. And, I mean, double, you know, two lines for every line. And it was maybe 12 or 14 verbatim quotes from Bush. And I would just read them on stage. No embellishment. One was, "I think we can all agree the past is over." But my favorite was, "The problem with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur." The lovely Mobius of that, you know, the fact that he can say it, but he doesn't know it, and oh.
What did you think, since you brought up the correspondence dinner, what is the comic eyes view of what Stephen Colbert did? Because I would think...
We got in an argument about this.
Did you really?
Yeah, you and I did.
Oh.
You and I did.
I don't remember.
Yeah, because you thought, and I understand people, because at that point it was like 6 years in to Bush, and it was right after Katrina, and no one was speaking truth to power, and Colbert finally, and all these progressives around the country, and yes, yes, and 30 seconds?
Minutes.
Holy crap. Oh, 30 minutes. Oh, all right. And all these, and I thought it was bad because he didn't make the crowd laugh, that he was shooting past the crowd. So he didn't fulfill his job description, which was to provide entertainment. He saw it as a greater duty, but he made all the journalists nervous. And, you know, some great lines. One great line was, you got to admire George Bush because he's resolute. He will think the same thing on Wednesday as he did on Monday, no matter what happens on Tuesday. You know, which I thought was a great line. But he ruined it for political comedy. And the next year they had Rich Little or something, or, you know, so they wouldn't have a political comic back because, and they do this all the time. It happens, you know, it happened with Don Imus. Remember, Imus said something incredibly unseemly in the presence of the president and the first lady, and then so he got crap for that, and then they didn't have stand-up comedy for two more years. I mean, political comedy. You know, they had some guy doing, I don't know, cute puppy dog material, and so it always it's like this another wave. You know, people go too far, and then. So I think Seth Meyers 2 years ago did a great job. Kimmel did a good job this year, you know, where you got to run that fine line because it's a fine line, you know, to push the edge of the envelope and not puncture it so that all the evil leaks in.
Now I'm remembering why we disagreed about this. It's all coming back to me.
Yeah.
Another question from the audience. Would Rick Santorum have won if he'd won the GOP primary? Santorum versus Obama.
You know, it's very interesting because Santorum actually won Iowa. And even though Ron Paul got the most delegates, but they didn't announce that. And this is one of the untold stories of this election was Romney and his Iowa campaign team was running the primary, so Romney was announced as the winner of the Iowa caucuses, and 5 days later they go to New Hampshire and he's got the momentum and he's got money coming in. But Santorum actually won Iowa, and 3 weeks later they announced it. Oh yeah, by the way, Rick Santorum. What was that? Santorum actually won. And think of how it would have changed. He would have got, because he was so dead broke. And the fact that he was able to hang on, he actually won those plain states. You know, he won three states in a row, and I think it was North Dakota, Minnesota, and something else. And so if he had had, oh, and, but he was actually so, he bragged that he was so frugal, he flew middle seats on United. Seriously, man, we're supposed to hand the presidency to a guy who can't find anybody on her staff who can work a seat locator map on an airline website. So that person is right. It would have changed the character of the race immensely if they had figured out, you know, if they'd been able to do arithmetic in Iowa in January.
Well, Santorum is very overt about his Christianity, and of course Mitt Romney was a Mormon. There are certain respects and rules around making fun of people's religions or bringing them into the comic arena. How does that figure when you're in the political arena, but that has come into, religion has come into politics? How do you deal with that?
I thought Romney skirted the issue. I mean, I wanted to know, and nobody ever asked at any of the debates, how many of the five boys were conceived through the magic underwear. I think America has the right to know if a man running the country wears magic underwear. And that was never brought up. And Santorum, a little to the right of Pol Pot, Santorum, I don't have any idea what he believes in. All I know about Santorum is what he doesn't believe. He doesn't believe in global warming. He doesn't believe in evolution. He doesn't believe in public education. He's homeschooling his kids. He went to Harvard. His wife went to Harvard. But he's homeschooling his kids. He doesn't believe in contraception, not just for him and his people, for anybody. Really? Birth control now? What's next? The transistor radio is a double spatula, you know.
What's your take on Clint Eastwood's performance?
You know, that's another bad Romney moment. Because Romney picked him, and Romney didn't vet him. Well, what are you going to do? I'll make it up as I go along. All right. He upstaged the nominee's acceptance speech by losing an argument to an empty chair. Outside of that, I thought it was a brilliant performance. Actually, it wasn't that bad of a skit. You know, talking to, you know, well, I can't do that to myself. It wasn't a bad skit, but not for the Republican National Convention, you know. Maybe the Every Which Way But Loses rap party or something. But and no one, oh, and he had the hair, he had that tuft, it looked like he had woken from a nap, and no one, you know, like you would do. But no one's going up to Dirty Harry, and, you know. Oh, it was, and it was, that convention was cursed. That's the second Republican convention, second one in a row, to lose a day because of a hurricane. They lost a day in St. Paul in 08 with McCain and Palin. They lost a day because there was a hurricane coming up, and this same thing this time. You don't think they're still paying for Katrina?
We're going to move to how you put your act together. What's your process of collecting material and refining a joke for performance? And are there regional differences in what plays?
What I'm doing right now is I'm trying to throw some generic stuff in my act. And this is an example of what I go through. So I have like three or four things about tattoos. You know, and I think my new show is going to be about baby boomers because there's a lot of us and we have money. And so I'm talking about tattoos and the fact that tattoo me. I won't even put a sticker on my laptop. So that worked. And I'll include that into the bit. And then a couple of other lines that I have are, you know, you got to remember the deterioration of the canvas. You know, that cute little butterfly suddenly turns into a pterodactyl. Okay, that works. I have other stuff that I'm working on. One is about when you go to a formal gathering and you see a woman in a backless gown and there's a tattoo on her back of a laughing skull popping a wheelie on a motorcycle made out of marijuana smoke, you know. Okay, that doesn't work, but but I will refine that. And what I'll do is I'll try out the jokes one by one, make sure that there's a laugh there, and then I'll compile them because it has to be a bit. I don't have random lines here. It's got to be somehow get it in and get out so it's modular so the piece, I can put it anywhere in my act. So it's not A, B, C, D, E, F, G, it's A, L, C, F, you know, but they're all pieces, and they're all chunks, and they all have to have modular openings and closes so that I can go somewhere else or come out of somewhere else with it.
What about the regional business?
I don't care. I don't care. But every performance is like a fingerprint. I mean, every performance, if the first three lines of a bit aren't getting laughs, I'm not going to belabor you with the next three lines. I'm going to skip over, and there's stuff that you know is not going to work. Religion jokes don't work in the Midwest. They work on the East Coast and West Coast, you know, with the godless ones. So you just know that, and you don't go in there. I do a lot of corporate gigs, and my corporate gigs I take great pains to do bipartisan for every Republican joke, make sure there's a Democratic joke. I do, because that's where I make most of my money. I can't do the clubs with the bachelorette party at the second show Friday and 8 to 22-year-old girls, one wearing a lace penis on her forehead. And I'm trying to do jokes about raising the debt ceiling. And it's not fair to her, you know? That's why I wear tennis shoes on stage. And everybody says, oh, you know, a couple of reasons. One, it makes me look like a clown, which I like, you know, to reinforce that. It's supposed to be funny. It's also why I like having a straight microphone stand with a microphone in it and a cord, because people think stand-up comedy when they see that with a stool next to it, and that reinforces stand-up comedy, and I wear big white shoes on stage. And also, I can move. I can move, and that's another coloration that happens to the bit, and when you get when it's imprinted on your DNA in terms of timing for you have all the words. For instance, I do a lot of memory tricks in my act, where, you know, I talk about at the end of the Bush administration, I had this 237-word rant where I'm so sick and tired of these lying, thieving, holier-than-thou, right-wing, cruel, crude, rude, coarse, crass, cocky, corrupt, criminal, dissolute, and then I would just go on, and it was 237 words that it gave me. And so I have a couple of things like that in my act right now. One of them is about Anthony Weiner. I don't know why he was kicked out of Congress. He didn't do anything illegal. You know, you can't kick somebody out for being unseemly. You got to assemble a quorum once in a while. You know, let's see, what do we got today? There's an idiot, an oaf, a cat, a fool, a lout, a creep, a toad, a butt wipe, a lizard stick, an ogre, a squeeze bag, a geek, a goon, a thug, a vandal, a Nimrod, two Nimrods, an Aiken, Weiner, Johnson, Boner, Bachman. I'll come back tomorrow. And it didn't work when I only had 11, but now that I have 16, it works. Because the longer I do it, and at the end of my set, I do this, you saw it, where I do the ads, you know, and they got the, in the event, you know, some side effects may include, but are not limited to, headache, nausea, flatulence, dizziness, dizzy flatulence, weight loss, weight gain, hives, chives, weird rashes on the inner thighs, involuntary muscle spasms, cement-like bowel obstructions, anthrax, dysentery, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, flesh-eating bacteria, explosive diarrhea, chlamydia, anal leakage, leprosy, Glock elbow, nickel dick phobia, cat scratch fever, river slobber syndrome, Ebola, elephantiasis, brain cloud, cholera light, partial total paralysis, total partial paralysis, total paralysis, suicidal thoughts or actions, death-like coma, near death, and fatigue. And when you can remember it, and I've memorized that to the point where it is imprinted on my DNA, and once I shoot into it, I can just relax, and then you can fill it. You can fill it with, you know, I have the person who's doing it looking down at their nails, and so I'm filling it with a character, and the same thing with the rest of my act, which was great when I was doing the little one-man show at the Marsh, because I got to do it for 41 weeks, and I got good at this stuff, and I would do it over and over, and it was lush like a tropical rainforest. There were jokes that nobody got. And but there were enough that they did get, and it just got more and more distilled, you know, and flavors would, like an oak, you know. It was yeah. So that's
We're gonna take some questions from the audience with the mic over on the side of the room here, so if you'll light it there recall the admonition/advice about keeping it personal and short, and a question rather than a statement. In the meantime, does political humor...
Since there's nobody over there.
You're good.
You're Angie Coiro, ladies and gentlemen, one of the best voices in radio in the Bay Area.
Does political humor leave itself open to hecklers? Or is it everybody kind of, they're all of a political mind, that's why they chose to see Will Durst? Do you have to deal with hecklers?
You know, very rarely. One time someone threw an ashtray at me. This was back when there was still smoking. And it was a glass ashtray, and I ducked, and it smashed on the back wall, and they carried her out. And she said, no, but I was, it was, I was laughing so hard I wanted to. It was just a physical thing. And one time, I was doing the end rant, the Bush rant. I called it my drum solo. And I was in Sacramento, and some guy got out of the audience and started trying to. But I had a microphone, and I had a rhythm, and there were lights on me, and I was 2 feet above him, and he thought he was going to compete with me, and I, dude, you know, go for it. And then he started coming at me on stage, and no, I demand my rights, and it was a First Amendment, and then he was an out-of-work right-wing talk show host in Sacramento who thought he would get arrested. Eddie, he was detained, and the cops came, and he had called the TV stations, and they said, we're not interested. So that's what he thought he was going to do.
Yeah. I want to go back to something. When we were talking about Deb, and she had to deal with the fact that they'd already gotten a woman, and I'm assuming that even though we've come a long way, baby, there's still, in the world of comedy, there seems to be a preference for men. I mean, you're never going to call and say, well, we already got a guy, so.
It's such a testosterone, it's a Y chromosome field, and part of it has to do with the rejection, the constant rejection. But you need a cast iron gut. And also, women are not bred to be part of this combative field that stand-up comedy is, and the ones that we see, the ones who are good, Lisa Lampanelli, and the ones who have shot through it, and Rita Rudner, you know, a beautiful woman. It's even harder for a pretty woman, because I know two female comics started out when I did in the early 80s in the Bay Area, like the other cafe or stuff, and they both had to quit because of stalkers. Because of weird stalkers, they just couldn't, because they weren't in a position where they were successful enough that they could, you know, slough it off, and they, I don't need this crap, and they both, so, and then there's club owners.
Yes.
Oh, my living God, the worst, just the worst. Of course, when you say greedy, idiot club owner, it's like saying egotistical comic, so it's part of the deal. And so that's one of the major reasons. But you see Sarah Silverman, and, you know, so smart and so brave, and Janine Garofalo, the same thing, and what they had to go through in order to get where they are. You know, it's twice the rocky road that a male comic has to go through.
I can't tell if you're lined up for a question there. Dive right in.
Do you have a stalker?
Huh?
Do you have a stalker?
Minor, not bad, nothing. You know.
That's not my question, though. Lewis Black said that after the second Bush left office, that he really had a scramble for material, that the world wasn't nearly as funny and there wasn't as much available to him to laugh at. Do you think that's true?
Oh, very, very true. And Lewis... the guy on HBO actually had a good line. He said, it was good for the country, but lousy for comedy, that Romney lost. Because Romney was so rife. The problem with Obama is that he's so clean. He's so smooth. And he's a black guy in a white guy world. So I mean, there's that. And the fact that he was a facilitator in Chicago, so he brought, his gig is to bring people together, and so all the rough edges have been shaved off, and he's like chamois on chrome. He really is. Clinton was a corpulent womanizer, and Bush had the DUIs and the DTs and the STDs, the ADHDs. And that's one of the things. There's no, shall we say, what do you call that when you're mountain climbing? What do you call the pylon or something?
Piton.
The piton. Where there's no room there to dig a piton in. You know, lovely family. You know, people coming down at people are are yelling at Michelle Obama for her anti-obesity program? Who's pro-obesity? I mean, so that's what happened. It was, you know, the anti-Obama response was way out of line. And it was racist, if not racist. And I have family members who would send me these emails, family members from Wisconsin send me these emails, and they were disgusting and racist. Ah, ha, ha, ha. And they think they're funny. Ah, ha, ha. And oh, man, and the Tea Party, and then all that happened. So thank God for ignorance.
But is part of it about Obama that, in a sense, he doesn't seem to take himself so seriously? He seems to have an ability to play along, to laugh at himself. Does that work against you?
No, yeah, a little bit. I mean, it was the same thing with Reagan. Reagan was great to make fun of because Reagan had a sense of humor about himself. Jimmy Carter, ooh, it was like you were kicking a sick puppy, you know? I mean, ooh. But Reagan, hope you're Republican.
You still have Michelle Bachmann to kick around.
Ah, yes. Yes. And who said that? Who said, thank God that she won? Was it Louis Black? It might have been. Because we need, we need that contingent. We need the black and white people.
In fact, I think I read that she set a record in fundraising.
No, really?
I don't know.
For a congressional seat?
If that gives you any security about your job, I mean, she's going to keep coming back, apparently.
Well, you know, the electorate. I mean, you look at California. We voted down that. And I'm a smoker. I smoke cigarettes. I'm down to 5 or 6 a day, mostly because I live in San Francisco. You know. Is that a cigarette? No, it's a joint. Well, it better be. But I was big in favor of, you know, the dollar a pack, and I couldn't believe that people voted against that. And I got in a huge argument in the lobby of the Fairmont Hotel with this guy who said, well, you know, not all the cancer research money was going to be spent in California. Where the hell do you think it's going to be spent? Wyoming? All the cancer research universities in Wyoming? It's cancer research! And I'm screaming at him in the lobby of the Fairmont. I was 86 from the Fairmont. Because they were outspent 8-1. And who was it? The GMO, the labeling.
Monsanto.
Yeah, Monsanto outspent. So, but that's a good thing because if they outspent it 8-1, and it still came that close, it's just a matter of time. Just a matter of time. One would hope.
Okay, so you've just made a statement about Monsanto, and I'm assuming that means they're not going to call you for their next convention. So how do you balance political comedy with getting most of your income from corporations?
I'm harmless. I'm harmless.
Are there companies that you literally know they're not going to call me?
Lawyers love me.
Why?
Because they understand the slippery nature of the truth. It's true. Lawyers do love me because it's about looking at things through my lens, and they can see it through the lens, and it's all conjecture on my part. It's all hypothesis, you know. I don't lie in my act. There are two lies. Sarah Palin never went to the whaling wall and said, whaling used to be a huge industry in Alaska, don't you know? Okay, that's... That's one of the lies. But I tell the audience that she didn't do that right away. So. But everything else is kind of, you know, it's the truth. It's just a different, you know, slot. The other lie is Herman Cain actually said, the Koch brothers are my brothers from another mother. He said that. He did say that. And he said, I'm in it to win it. And bros before hoes. No, he didn't say that one.
So is your act...
Thank you for asking.
So is your act different then for a corporation? What is your act before a corporate audience as opposed to a comedy club audience?
I'll do more Obama jokes. I'll do Joe Biden jokes. You know, Joe Biden isn't just a loose cannon, he's a loose aircraft carrier. Obama's a lawyer, Biden's a lawyer, 13 of their 18 cabinet appointments are lawyers. How effective can a government be when it shuts down every time an ambulance roars up Pennsylvania Avenue? No matter what you think of Obama's policies, you got to admire his ability not to get involved in them. see that knowing laugh. Yeah, so, I mean, there's always something. And then I'll pull out material from 100 years ago, do my lawyer jokes. I got this bipartisan riff that I used to do, and I'll bring that. 20% of America is far left, 20% is far right. Rest of us are in the middle. You never hear about us. You know, it's always Ann Coulter on one side or Sheryl Crow on the other. Sheryl Crow is a wonderful singer, but she wants everybody in America restricted to one square of toilet paper per bathroom visit. All right, lady, but you're doing my laundry. And in the spirit of full disclosure, you should know I like chili.
On that pleasant note.
No, don't let me end there. No, not on that one.
Well, actually, before we end, I wanted to ask you about the changes in the different industries that you're in. He and I have come together any number of times through radio and television.
I used to have a radio show. It was
Will and Willie.
Will and Willie with Willie Brown. And because we got it last minute, we still had many commitments in the following year. Both of us oftentimes were gone. Not oftentimes, but at least probably once every 2 weeks, one of us was gone. And Angie would come in, and she would be Stunt Willie. And so she and I worked together quite a bit.
The costuming was difficult, one to the other, but I got used to it.
Great hat.
But those industries are changing. Is that going to have any impact on... I mean, TV is still making money. Radio has stopped making money. Is that tangential enough to your career that it's not going to worry you? Or is your industry changing as well?
No, I'm going to become a lion tamer. I'm still going to stay in the business, but I've always wanted to join the circus. And I've been writing a lot more. I write for a magazine called The Progressive Magazine. I'm in there once. I write for The Huffington Post. My stuff gets syndicated in various small newspapers around America. I never know which ones until I get an angry email from Osceola, Florida, or Prescott, Arizona. And I want to keep up with that. And I want to keep performing. I want to keep doing, you know. I can't earn a living at any one thing. I patched together a comedy quilt of a bunch of stuff. But I really love getting on stage. And when it works, it's better than anything. When it works, I mean, you can write and you can turn a clever phrase and you can get people email you, say, oh, that was a great column. But when you're on stage and it's working, and the bartender who wouldn't even acknowledge you before you walked into the club after the show hands you a beer and says, I haven't seen anything like that. Man, there's something magical about it. Yeah, that's when it works.
And when it doesn't work?
Oh, when it doesn't work, it's awful. It's awful. Oh, my God. And you remember everything. You remember every nanosecond. When it doesn't work, when it works, it's a blur. It's the way you should. But when it doesn't work, it's in 24-point type bold with a parenth and underline and flashing like a strobe. It's like, oh, yeah. I won't do the physical thing.
But there's always another show.
Yes, yes, and that's the good part. Boom, maintain and move on, and you get a 20. You get 8 hours of self-pity, and then you have to move on.
And that's a wrap with political satirist Wilders. Thank you, Will.
Hey, thanks. One question. Big microphone. No question.
I have to say this first, then I gavel to a close. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet.
Radio?
And, yeah.
Thank God I didn't say shit, huh?
I'm Angie Cuero, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place you're in the know, is now adjourned.